Steve, but before I get into those thoughts, let me just remind me, and thus remind you as I remind myself, that our God is actively at work accomplishing His purposes. Sometimes I think, as I go through the course of the day, that God's kind of up there. He's there, He's aware of things, you know, and He's maybe on a siesta or having a cup of tea or something. But that's not how He is. Our Father is continually at work accomplishing His purposes in the world and in our own lives. And as we come to this passage, I hope that you can see that truth exemplified in these two chapters. And the first chapter, if you notice in chapter 29, I want you to mark down three things for me. you remember that David is down with the Philistines, particularly with King Achish in the city of Gath. The Philistines have about five little city-states down on the Mediterranean coast. And I like this map, and I'll refer to this, I think, later on. But down on the coast, there are five city-states that the Philistines have inhabited, and this is where their power base is, and Gath is one of these little city-states, and Achish happens to be the ruler over Gath. And I want you to notice how he views his relationship with David in this chapter, beginning in verse 3. The commander of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" You remember the Philistines are on the march. We'll come back to this and look at it in detail in a moment. They're on a march up to the north to battle against Saul and the Israelites. And on the way there, David is with his men traveling with Achish. And the Philistine commanders notice that David's marching along with them. And so they say to Achish, "What are these Hebrews doing here? We're going to fight them, you know. I mean, I know David, you're kind of your pet boy here, but he's not a Philistine. But what are you doing?" And Achish said to the commanders, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who's been with me these days, or rather these years?" It's been about 16 months. "And I've found no fault in him from the day he deserted me to this day." All right, there's commendation number one. Look down in verse 5. The Philistine leaders say to King Achish, "Is this not David of whom they sing and dance, saying Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? And then Achish called David to him, and here's the second commendation. "As the Lord lives, you have been upright, and you're going and you're out and you're coming in with me and the army are pleasing in my sight, for I have not found evil in you from the day of your coming to me to this day." Alright? Now, notice in chapter, we're still at this same chapter, 29, verse 8, "And David said to Achish, but what have I done? And what have you found in your servant from the day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go up and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" And here's the third commendation. "But Achish answered and said to David, I know that you're pleasing in my sight. You're like an angel of God to me. Nevertheless, the commander of the Philistines said, you must not go up and fight in the battle." Three commendations from King Achish, who's a Philistine, to David, who's an Israelite. And this brings me to my first point, chapter 29. It's this. God sovereignly protects us so we can accomplish things for Him. God sovereignly protects us so that we can accomplish things for Him. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that God has been working behind the scenes, orchestrating this whole scenario so that David would end up being protected so that he could accomplish the things God had intended for David. Well, let's begin in verse 1. The Philistine commanders reprimand Achish, and that's in verses 1 through 5. In verse 1, we see the commanders of the Philistine city-states are mustering their army, you know, together, and they're all going to converge in this place called Aphek. And now, Aphek is on the coast, As you begin to make your way north, the Philistines are all going to congregate from the various spy cities with all of their armies in this one place. They're all going to gather together, and then in one mass they're going to march north to the valley of Jezreel to fight against King Saul and the Israelites. And so they muster the troops in verse 1, and in verse 2, the lords of the Philistines are proceeding, and they notice that David and his men were traveling along with Achish. He's bringing these 600 mercenaries along. And as we read already, Achish has no reason in his mind that David shouldn't come. Why not? You've been a good boy for 16 months. I'm going to bring you along. And so he's doing that. And it's when they notice that David is there. And in verses 4 and 5, the other Philistine kings turn and notice in verse 4, the commanders of the Philistines were angry with Achish. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Make them go back, that he may return to his place where you've assigned him. Don't let him go into battle, lest he become our adversary." Well, they had a good point. I mean, he may be acceptable to Achish, but to the Philistine leaders, it doesn't make sense to bring an enemy whose people are going to go fight in our rear. This guy could turn on us. Don't you have any sense, Achish? Don't you know what's going on? And notice, they saw that David could turn against them, and they used the same phrase that Achish used. Notice in verse 3, in the middle of the verse, Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David?" And then notice in the beginning of verse 5, they said, "Is this not David?" They're mocking Achish, and they're reminding him, "Yeah, this is David, all right, but you got it all wrong, Achish. This guy could turn on us. Saul slaying his thousands, and David is 10,000. And so, in verse, at the end of this section here, we see that the commanders of the Philistines don't want David around. So in the rest of the chapter, 6 to 11, David is excluded from the battle. That's when Achish says to him in verse 6, "You've been a good friend of mine, but you're not pleasing to the Philistine leaders." He swore to David, as a matter of fact, in verse 6. Achish called David and said, "As the Lord lives, as your Lord lives." Now think about this for a moment. Achish is a Philistine. They have their god Dagon and many other gods, and yet he is forced in this situation to acknowledge David's king, David's god. He says, "As your Lord lives, I'm going to swear to you that I will not harm you." David had not won the confidence of the commanders of the Philistines, but he'd won the confidence of Achish. So in verse 8, David appeals, "What have I done? He's done nothing to deserve. He's a warrior." So this is kind of a slap in the face to him, that he's been turned away, he doesn't deserve this. And he professed that he wanted to go into battle, and notice what he says. "What have I done and found your servant this day when I came before you to this day that I might not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" Well, David's been doing this all along. David's been down in Ziklag, 25 miles to the south, and he's been fighting the enemies of Achish all along for the past 16 months. It just so happened that the enemies of Achish that he was fighting were also the enemies of the Israelites. And it seemed to me that David's thinking is, "I'm going to go north with the Philistines. I'm going to go into battle. They're going to fight against my own people." But it seems to me that David's not going to fight the Israelites if he goes. He hadn't been doing so to date. We don't know what the details of David's battle plan is in his mind as he's in this situation. But I would assume he would do something like he's already been doing. What was that? Somehow invading the enemies of the Philistines and not harming the Israelites and serving both at the same time. So in verses 9 to 11, as this chapter ends here, for the third time, Achish vindicates David in verse 9. He'd been no trouble to the Philistine king whatsoever. He'd brought much favor to Achish. Remember all the booty that he had garnished from, and the plunder he had garnished from his warfares down in Ziklag, the area of Ziklag. He brought some of that to Achish for 16 months. Achish had lived off the fruits of David's labor. Why wouldn't he think David's a good guy? Consequently, though, when it's all said and done in verse 11, David has to return. He arose early in the morning and departed from the Philistines and went south. As a matter of fact, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. As a matter of fact, God is working in such a way that David is going as far away from the battle as God can take him. The Philistines are going north into the Jezreel Valley, and David is going south to Ziklag, almost the furthest southern city in the Israelite territory. So he's going to be as far away from this battle as God can take him. Now, what's the point? I think the point is, God works to protect us in situations in which we are threatened, in situations which could turn against us. He works to protect us that we can still accomplish things for Him. Now, here's an encouraging revelation in this chapter of how God takes care of His own when they're under extreme stress. David's been running out of ideas how to protect himself, how to preserve his life. He's scrambling. During his time in Philistine territory, he apparently received very little special revelation from God, so he resorted to figuring out how to apply what he already knew about God in his situation so that he could spare his life. He convinced Achish of his loyalty. David gave him a measure of protection as a result. He also convinced the other Philistine lords of David's ability to work. And yet, when it's all said and done, here's the idea. God providentially caused the reactions of people, as different as these people are, so that David would be protected. Even when we don't sense it, even when we are unaware of it, God cares for us like a shepherd. God does sovereignly protect us so that we can do things for Him. Now, I'm going to suggest that David is unaware. He doesn't know everything God is up to. All he can do is respond to the situation as it unfolds. But all along the way, God is sovereignly and providentially protecting him so that he can accomplish things for God. That's no different than what God does for us today. We're unaware of it. We don't know how God does it. We don't know when He does it. But God sovereignly is actively engaged in protecting His people so they can accomplish things for Him. Hebrews talks about the fact that God uses angels as His emissaries and servants of protection of His people. I don't know of any time in my life when I can say, you know, I know that God protected me in a very difficult situation so that I could continue to serve Him. I don't have a testimony like that. So I've heard some people who do, and you have too probably, where they can honestly say, if I look back on the situation, I wasn't aware at the moment. And by the way, David does the same thing. The Psalms are written, many of them, about these episodes in his life. And you can read many of those Psalms because he reflects back upon God's protection of him. And he can see, looking back with the eye of faith, God's hand of protection so that he could continue to serve in the most distressful, difficult situations in which he lived. So our God is out there sitting in a chair waiting for us to die and go see Him. He's actively engaged. The interesting thing about the God of the Bible is that He is intimately and deliberately engaged in the affairs of His people. He's not just a God who's up there lording it over us, manipulating situations, and waiting for us to see Him. He is personally engaged, alive, and active in your life and mine. And one way He is by protecting us so that we can serve Him in distressful and harmful situations we possibly find ourselves. Well, let me suggest a second sovereign work of God beginning in chapter 30. I'm also going to suggest that God sovereignly, while He sovereignly protects us that we can serve Him, God sovereignly perfects us so that our ability to lead in crisis can bring God glory. God sovereignly perfects us through our circumstances, through our situations, so that our ability to lead in crisis can bring God glory. Now, here in chapter 30, I'm going to suggest that David is an outstanding leader. As Saul continued to decline, God continued to perfect David and built into him qualities and characteristics of leadership that prepared him for the throne. If you're like me, we don't like preparation mode. You know, we want to get past preparation mode to get to execution mode. You know? I don't want to train for that 5-day hike. I just want to go on it. See? And if you're like me, 2 weeks ago, that's what I did. I thought, okay, I've got some time. I want to go do that 22-mile loop up at the Red Bridge. And so I took off with my dog and my 50-pound pack, and I headed out. 5 miles in, at 4 p.m, I thought, my goodness, the sun really looks low. Maybe I'll stop here and set up camp. Well, you know, I mean, I still had a few hours of sunlight, but I wasn't going any further, folks. I was 4 or 5 miles into it, and my dog agreed, so we set up camp. And that night, as I'm sitting there eating my ham sandwich and thinking, okay, I got 17 more miles to go. In the middle of the night, when I got cramps and I woke up at 3:30, couldn't go back to sleep, so I sat by the fire till the sunlight came out again over the trees, and I thought to myself, so, you're going to pack up and get out, you're going back home. And so I packed up, I took my dog, and she agreed, and we hiked back out. And I was home by 10:30 in the morning. I had this great hike, though, Scott. Well, you know, we don't like preparation mode. I realize I haven't done any hiking like that since last fall, and it just wasn't going to happen. David is in preparation mode. He's been in preparation mode for quite a while. We like execution mode. And what God is doing in this chapter is preparing him for his leadership in crisis, because God is perfecting him so he can lead in crisis for God's glory. Now in 1-6, David responds to a major crisis. You know, remember, he's got his marching orders, so now he's heading back to Ziklag, all the way down to the south. And let me just see if Ziklag here. He's marching all the way down back to his homestead, place Achish had him for the past 16 months, where David had been doing his own reconnaissance and knocking off enemies and bringing booty to the Israelites as well as to Achish, and kind of setting things up so when he became king, he'd at least have the southern part of Judah on his team. Because as I mentioned to you before, David's not out of crisis yet. Once David becomes king, he's got 8 years of a civil war. Because most of the tribes in the north are still for Saul's dynasty and his family. And so the battles aren't over yet. And so David's ingratiating himself to the southern tribes, and as he's bringing them booty from the battles and so on, what he's been doing. But I want you to notice something. It happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid in the south, and then over in Ziklag, and over through the city. Well, why wouldn't they? You know, all the army, the warriors are gone, so they're sitting duck. But I want you to notice something. See the phrase, the third day? Mark that, and then come down to verse 12, the end of the verse, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. And then notice again, at the end of verse 13, the guy says, when I fell sick 3 days ago. Three. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment and explain something to you. But notice, the Amalekites raided, verse 2, they took everybody captive, and notice, without killing anybody, carried everything off. Verse 3, David and his men arrived. They probably smell the smoke miles away because it's a flat area and it's ominous. And they get closer to the city and they see the smoldering ruins and everything they had, families, goods, everything is in jeopardy. And they arrive in verse 4 and they come to the city and the smoldering ruins, and they lifted their voices. They must have thought the worst. And they wept until there was no strength for them to weep. They'd lost everything in their minds. These are warriors. I mean, they're brought to their knees. In 4 to 6, David joined his men in weeping over the tragedy that the enemies of God's kingdom had caused. And then notice something interesting. David's supporters then turned on him and almost stoned him to death. Now he's got trouble on two fronts. He's got the Philistines he's living with and what's going on there, and now he's got his own people. He's literally caught between a rock and a hard place. But notice what he does. In his distress, he calls on the Lord. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. That's the difference between David and Saul. He strengthened himself in God's faithfulness. Now, David is doing here in verse 6 what he does when he writes the Psalms. Because literally it says, and David strengthened himself in God's faithfulness. What he's doing is he's taking a moment to look back on what God has done for him to date. And that strengthens him right now to face a future that's unknown. He doesn't know what's going to happen, where they're going to go, what's going to take place. But he's relying upon God's faithfulness to somehow guide him through his current situation. And notice God provides some guidance for him in verses 7 through 10. David asked the high priest to bring the Urim and the Thummim. That was the way God wanted the kings to determine his will when it came to crisis situations. And David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue him? And shall I overtake the enemy who's done this to Ziklag? And God said, pursue. So David and his 600 men took off, and they pursued, verse 10, his 400 men until they got to the place, or 600 men until they got to Bezor, which is a brook. 200 of the men were exhausted. They left them there. And the rest of them continued on their journey. Verses 11 through 15, while they're on the journey, David finds kindness from an Egyptian servant. Notice in verse 11, all this is just happenstance, right? Just all kind of happening. Well, God's weaving it together. Verse 11, they found an Egyptian in the field, brought him to David, gave him bread, he ate it, fed him. He had not eaten or drunk for 3 days or three nights. And David asked him who he was, and he said, I was with the Amalekites. He confirmed they destroyed the city. And he said, I've been left here 3 days ago. And then he talks about the raid in verses 14 and 15. And you can see the raid here. I'll show it to you.
The Amalekites live here. They raised up here. They raised up in the Negev. And then they raised up over the Canaanite word. They came down and raided this flag. And now they're taking off with all their booty.
So they raided about five or six places. It's a large army of desert raiders called the Amalekites. And they know that they got a hightail out of Dodge before the Philistines and David and his men get back. So now they're taking off, heading back south into the desert and the wilderness with all of their booty. And they left this Egyptian servant behind because, he was delaying things. He was sick and he could be spared. So he's left out in the desert to die, which is what you did
when you're trying to hightail it out of Dodge so you don't get caught. Anything that's going to be a problem, we just kind of leave it behind and we move on. Well, this Egyptian guy is found, and he tells them the whole story. And in verse 15, David said, will you bring me down to this band? And the guy says, swear to me by God that you won't kill me. or you won't hand me back into the hands of my master who will kill me, and I'll bring you down to him. So he becomes a scout. And but I want you to stop for a minute, because notice he says, I fell sick 3 days ago. Let me come back to this three for a moment, because it's interesting that it's in this passage. The idea of three in the Bible seems to always carry the additional sense of further action. For instance, Jonah was in the belly of the whale how many days? 3 days and three nights. And the idea is that something's going to happen. But we know something happened. He was spewed out of his mouth. Jesus was in the tomb how many days? 3 days, three nights. But it's the idea of three gives anticipation. Something's going to happen. What happened? He was resurrected. And so when we come across the three here in this chapter, if you're in tune to that, the writer's letting us know that something's going to happen. That all is not lost. We read initially that the city's been destroyed and everybody's gone and we would think they're dead. But the writer wants us to know as the story is unfolding that something's going to happen. Something further is going to happen. And what's going to happen is David's going to bring deliverance. And so in verses 16 to 20, David has a successful victory over the Amalekites. We had it read to us, but you can take a look at it. They're feasting on their plunder. They've taken. Even though the Egyptian they left behind had received nothing to eat when he fell ill, they didn't have anything to give him. They wanted to keep it themselves. And David launched his attack in the morning, and notice verse 18, David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. And notice, nothing of theirs was missing. Small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything, David brought it all back in addition to the sheep and the herd that he captured from the Amalekites. However, we do have the word that 400, notice in verse 17, except for 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. I can just see them all taken off. Can you imagine 400 of these guys on camels? I mean, that's a huge gain for the Amalekites. That's an army. And that just tells me that obviously the Amalekites were a much larger army than David's 400 men. And in verses 18 to 20, David recovers it all. Absolutely nothing is missing. In verses 21 to 22, the whole booty then is shared and distributed with all of David's followers. But we have a little vignette here. The rest of the chapter describes how the plunder is distributed, but notice verse 22, the wicked and worthless men who were with David said, hey, you know, he arrived back with these 200 men that he'd left at the brook because they were so exhausted they couldn't go any farther. So they arrived back to these 200 guys, and these worthless leaders said, hey, they didn't go with us. We're not going to give them anything. This is a moment of crisis, you know, a leadership moment. And David said in verse 23, no, my brothers, what the Lord's given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hand the band that came against us. Who will listen? For as his share is who goes down to battle, so shall his share be who stays with the baggage. David had a moment. He returned to these exhausted soldiers, and he greeted them, and he shared the booty with them. But notice he didn't stop there, because in verse 26, David went back to Ziklag, and he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, and then you got all, as a gift, from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, and then you got all the cities in which he had sent the booty. And then it concludes in verse 31, and those who were in Hebron and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. The booty is shared. I'm going to suggest that David's propensity to give made his new kingdom possible. He could have hoarded it all for himself. Now, what do we learn? Well, I'm going to suggest three things. First of all, even now, the Lord is sovereignly working to protect you, to accomplish things for Him. Even now, God is perfecting you to lead in crisis for His glory. He's always working this way. We make decisions. God makes decisions. Now, when we talk about God's sovereignty, what do we mean? What we mean is that all decisions that are being made will always be consistent with God's plans. David making real decisions. Achish is making real decisions. The Amalekites are making real decisions. The Philistine leaders are making real decisions. David's followers are making real decisions. Everybody's acting here. And yet God protects and perfects so these decisions are consistent with God's plans for David, so that David can accomplish things for the Lord. Listen, none of us ever have to worry if God's doing what He needs to be doing. You know, we find ourselves in a crisis situation, and our first question is, why am I here? Where is God at? What is He doing? You never have to worry about what God's doing. You know why? Because God's doing what God's doing. That's why. God will protect you. God will perfect you. Because sovereignly He's at work in your life so that you can bring glory to Him and you can enjoy the benefits of what it means to walk with God. We just need to make the most righteous decisions possible in the midst of our situations that we face and continue to act through these and knowing all along that God will do what God will do. David doesn't stop to ask what God's doing all throughout the episode. He simply deals with his situation, knowing that he's got a sovereign God who's at work, accomplishing his purposes, even though David can't see it. How can God be accomplishing anything in this situation I face myself? Well, God can do amazing things. Secondly, godly leadership is generous leadership. In actuality, you could take chapter 30 and you could talk about leadership. And you might say something like this. Leadership qualities in chapter 30 include empathy in verse 4, faith in verse 6, decisiveness in verse 10, kindness in verse 12, persistence in verse 17, integrity in verse 23, fairness in verse 24, and generosity in 25 to 31. One of the strongest emphases in this chapter is David's generosity. That's what the writer chooses to end with. The greatest giver in any situation is always the most influential person. The greatest giver in any situation or scenario we can come up with will always have the most influence. Generosity of life and living is what God calls us to. You never have to wonder if you should be generous in this situation. Generosity is the nature of God. So I'm going to suggest that godly leadership is generous leadership. If you want to be an influence, be a giver. Be a giver. That's why I often talk about my Mama Blanche. My Mama Blanche was my grandmother, so I think about Mothering Day. I think about her. Why was she such an influence in my life? I give you one word. Giver. She was a giver. She was a continual giver. Not just of money, but of herself, of her time, of her counsel, of her love. It didn't matter if I ever gave her anything. That wasn't going to change the fact that she was a giver to me. And the third thing I would suggest that we can learn from this is that what I've been saying all along, God is sovereign. God is sovereign. I have plans. You have plans. But often, isn't it true that our plans cannot be executed because of situations? Isn't that often true? I got plans. Can you believe once again? But you know what? Let's flip it for a moment. God has plans. And no matter what the situation arises, they become part of the fulfillment of God's plans. God's plans are never hindered. God is sovereign. God anointed David as the next king. And God was going to see to it that David was going to be Israel's next king. Neither Saul, who wanted to kill David, nor unfaithful Israelites, who despised David, nor the Philistine kings, who were fearful of David, nor his own soldiers, who wanted to stone David, and not even David himself, who made some stupid decisions as he's trying to figure out how to respond to life, none of that could keep David from becoming Israel's king. Why? Because God used all of that to accomplish his purposes and promises for David. Our God is reliable. Our God is trustworthy. And though the outcomes are often mysterious, I mean, you know, if I was God, I would probably have thought of a better plan to prepare David for the throne than God used, right? God's outcomes are mysterious. Why did God do it this way? This makes no sense. Let's put a little more logic to this situation, Father. And God's outcomes are mysterious to us. We don't know His ways. We can't figure Him out. But we can always trust His character. We can always trust His character. We're not omniscient, but the outcomes are always in our best interest, and they are for David as well. Well, next week we close our study of this book, and it's a sad story. Because as much as David is learning and being prepared and being robust and energized and trusting God and learning to be nimble and figure things out, as much as we see David being perfected, the writer finishes the book taking us back to King Saul. And we see the sorry end to a sorry reign. Let's pray together. Now, Father, I am so glad that You are in charge. I struggle a bit sometimes in my life because I am not privy to Your mind at work in my life situations. I can think of almost every scenario possible when I'm praying about something that would be an answer to my prayer, and yet You always find another one that I never thought of. And You're always at work because You genuinely care for me. You care for Your people. You're never preoccupied. Your eye is always upon us. And we face some very difficult situations from time to time, Father, that are very, very painful. And they cause anxiety and fear, as it did with David. Father, may we take His example and lean upon You and look back at Your faithfulness and let that hold us strong through these times. Never questioning You. Trusting and relying upon You because of who You are. We're grateful. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. If you'd like to stand.